Lucci.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The District Court erred in two respects. First, the District Court erred by finding, failing to recognize, consistent with congressional intent, that an inter-parties reexamination is a contested case in which the adverse parties have access to subpoenas under Section 24. No court has ever held that the right to subpoena may be abolished entirely in an adversarial administrative proceeding. Indeed, because appeals and inter-parties reexaminations proceed directly from the Patent Office to this court, Cordes' only opportunity to have Abbott's objective indicia evidence considered is by way of a Section 24 subpoena.
Now, the PTO doesn't call this contested, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What deference should we give to their reading of their own statute as to what is a contested case?
Your Honor, on that issue, the PTO is not entitled to any deference.
Because they don't administer Section 24.
That's one reason, Your Honor, correct. In fact, that's the main reason.
Well, the problem with that, it seems to me, is you look back at the history of this, the 23 and 24 came into the statute at the same time. They seem to be related. The circuit decisions before the creation of this court, particularly the Fifth Circuit decision in Brown, seem to suggest that the purpose of 24 is to allow for subpoenas in situations in which the PTO would authorize the receipt of the evidence that was subpoenaed. If we followed Brown, you lose, right?
I don't know that we lose, Your Honor. There's a distinction drawn in the cases between subpoenas issued for purposes of discovery and those issued for purposes of entry of evidence into the proceeding. And I believe the cases recognize that, even the ones defined as you mentioned. The interplay between Section 23 and 24, there definitely is interplay. But it's not the case that Section 24 provides for subpoenas only where provided by Section 23.
How do I know that?
Your Honor, you would know that because Section 23 says that the PTO may provide rules for the entry of affidavits. Whereas here, the PTO has not exercised its right to do that. Section 24 controls, and Section 24 provides in very clear terms that a party such as Cordes has the opportunity to go to the district court and seek that information. Here, you know, Section 23 is permissive. So there certainly is an interplay between the two, but 24 is not dependent on 23 if, as here, the Patent Office hasn't exercised its authority to promulgate rules.
Now, we're looking at the term contested case, right? And what you're saying is a contested case is something decided before examiners, not judges. It's something where there's no discovery, there's no cross-examination, there's no filing of motions. It's an administrative proceeding at an examiner level. Why is that a contested case?
Well, it can be a contested case, Your Honor, where certain other things are present. The key features of a contested case is the presence of an adversary and the opportunity for both parties, that adversary included, to introduce argument and evidence throughout the proceeding. And that's met here. There might be circumstances.
When I think of case, I tend to think of something more in a judicial setting. Am I misconstruing that term case?
Well, there judicial settings can, of course, be contested cases. But it's not the situation that a judicial setting is the only setting in which you can have a contested case.
I tend to call this a proceeding or an administrative action. Would I call it a case?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe it's a case, and it's a contested one in the sense that there are adversaries who have the opportunity throughout the proceeding and to the same extent to introduce both argument and evidence. Here, for example, Abbott had the opportunity to come in initially with its arguments for why the patent should be found obvious. And they came in with argument and evidence. Cordes came in with its argument and evidence. And Abbott had the opportunity to reload, to take a look at what Cordes had said and put in further arguments and, in fact, further evidence in the form of a declaration.
Is the prosecution of a patent application, is that a case?
It's a case, but not a contested one, Your Honor.
Well, isn't a reexamination going back and looking again at, or examining new and existing claims? Isn't it another form of a prosecution of the patent application?
It can be, Your Honor. Ex parte reexamination.
Isn't that what reexamination is?
Well, there are two types of reexamination, Your Honor. Where you have an ex parte reexamination, that's not contested because there isn't an adversary present who has the opportunity throughout the proceeding to introduce argument and evidence. The third party requester has the opportunity at the outset to put in argument and evidence. But after that, it's solely the patent owner having interplay with the patent office. We don't have the key feature of an adversary.
I know you called it a proceeding and not a case, which is kind of back to my point.
Well, Your Honor, that issue may be a semantic one.
It's the semantics in this case are the words of the statute, so have to follow it.
That's true, Your Honor. I think it is a case. I did use the term proceeding. I think case applies equally. I think the key word here, though, is contested. And what we have in an inter-parties reexamination, in contrast to an ex-parte reexamination, is a contested case where you have an adversary having the opportunity to present argument and evidence. And as I mentioned, there has never been a case holding that the right to subpoena in an adverse administrative proceeding can be abolished entirely. And that's what's being sought here.
How would this case come out if we were under the new statute, let's say in a post-grant review proceeding? I mean, would the PTO adopts rules that limit the discovery that's available?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And the PTO has adopted rules which limit the discovery. Could you, under 24, under the new statute, go into district court and say we're entitled to more in the way of a subpoena than the PTO has allowed us under its rules?
Your Honor, I believe that under the current rules for inter-parties review and for post-grant review, that the procedure would be such that it's stipulated in rules, unlike our situation, that the parties need to seek approval of the PTO for proceeding under Section 24. And if the PTO...
So you couldn't go into district court under 24 unless the PTO had authorized it?
That's correct, unless there was a challenge under the EPA, Your Honor.
Well, how's that different from this, then, since there's no PTO authorization here?
There's no PTO rule requiring authorization, Your Honor.
That's the difference?
That's one difference, Your Honor, correct.
Well, what's the other difference?
Well, I guess there are a whole host of rules that the PTO has applied in that situation for inter-parties review that aren't present here. That's probably the most salient one, is that at the time we served the subpoenas, the only legal authority on point was Section 24, and neither Section 24 nor any rule required us to do anything in the way of seeking PTO authorization.
But the rules seem to bar subpoenas under these circumstances, because the rules define this as not being a contested case.
Well, that's the key issue, whether the rules are silent on this point. The rules say that this is not a contested case, and therefore the PTO's rules do not apply. It's an open question, and it will be decided by this court as to whether Section 24, where the PTO hasn't exercised its authority under Section 23 to promulgate rules, nonetheless consistent with congressional intent, enables a party to seek subpoenas and to introduce evidence into the record.
I'm confused, because it seems to me that the agency has promulgated rules that say you can't get a subpoena under these circumstances because they've said this is not a contested case.
Well, Your Honor, to be clear, in that respect, they promulgated a rule that's inconsistent with the statute. They, in finding that this is not a contested case, it gets to the deference issue. The question is whether or not the PTO's view that this is not a contested case is entitled to deference, whether they were correct on that point. That's one of the central issues to this appeal. And on that point, they are wrong. They are entitled to no deference. All the historical indicators of what constitutes a contested case since Section 24 and its predecessor were enacted indicate that parties to an administrative procedure that has an adversarial aspect like this one are entitled to subpoenas for entry of evidence into the record. There's distinction drawn, and they're not entitled to discovery. That is, seeking information merely to seek more information that may be introduced into the record. There's a distinction drawn on that point. But it is the case that in the administrative setting, parties such as Cordis are entitled to subpoenas.
If we find that that a reexamination is a contested case, does that change our standard of review in it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe it's pursuant to Gartzai, I believe the standard for review for cases that have a complete record. And again, this is the issue we're seeking, is to have a complete record if there's ever a further appeal of this matter, where there's a complete record per Gartzai and also in Ray Lee, there's substantial deference, a substantial evidence test for review. And I don't believe that changes depending on the ruling here. I see that my time reserved, I'm into my reserve time, so.
You may reserve the rest of your time if you'd like.
Thank you.
Mr. Morin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The district court properly quashed Cordis' subpoenas for at least two reasons. First, the inter partes reexamination statute and 35 U.S.C. 314A in particular does not permit discovery. Second, reexaminations are not contested cases under 35 U.S.C. 24. And these separate reasons for affirmance stem from one basic fact, Your Honor. As the name reexamination would suggest, inter-parties reexaminations are examinational rather than adjudicative proceedings, which are conducted in front of staff examiners rather than in front of ALJs, which are closely modeled after initial examination procedures. Turning first to the Section 314A argument, Congress specifically modeled reexamination closely after initial examination. They provide in the statute that, except as otherwise provided in this section, reexamination shall be conducted according to the procedures established for initial examination under the procedures of Section 130.
Only referring to the procedures followed at the PTO. It doesn't seem to be addressing the question of Section 24.
Oh, it's not directly addressing in that portion of the Interparties Reexamination Statute, Your Honor, Section 24. What it is doing is setting up the process that Congress mandated when it set up the reexamination process, which is the procedures, except as we otherwise provide by statute, shall mirror the procedures for initial examination. That is why it's a reexamination. And if there were any question from the plain language...
This is a contested proceeding, though. You have responses. Whatever is served on the office has to be served on the other party. You have appeal rights. You have arguments made back and forth.
Well, first of all, I would disagree strongly that it's a contested case, as that term is used in Section 24. That's a term of art, which, as the Supreme Court has cautioned, can't just be derived down to its plain and ordinary generalist type of meetings. It's a term of art.
So you agree that the generalist meeting would favor an interpretation that it would cover an inter-parties re-exam?
I actually don't agree with that either. I think in general terms, you wouldn't call this a case. You'd call it a proceeding. And in general terms, while there is an element, if you were to ask someone without any knowledge of the legislative history of the statute, is there some type of a contest going on? Maybe you would get the answer being yes to the if you removed it from the terms of the statute. But the same answer would apply equally to an ex parte reexamination, which nobody suggests is a contested case. In ex parte reexamination,
in many administrative actions, we have rights to gain subpoenas. Why is this different?
Oh, it's very different. First of all, it's an examinational proceeding. And there has never been a case that has found that discovery is required under due process for examination, for example, in an administrative proceeding. Now, while they like to draw a distinction between, here's what happened. In their opening brief, they said we'd like these.
It's not a question, probably not a question of due process.
You're right.
A constitutional issue. As much as it is, as Chief Judge Rader suggests, it's sort of against the background of normal administrative practice. And we have to construe the statute in the light of what's done generally in administrative proceedings.
And if we do that,
and,
I would...
And in an administrative proceeding where there are opposing parties, you know, in general, if it's evidentiary in nature, one party can cross-examine or depose the other side's experts or witnesses, right?
First of all, I would say that's not necessarily correct. But second of all, I would say more to the point that Congress has spoken specifically to this issue. In Section 314A, just like they did in the ex parte reexamination statute, they chose to model the process after initial examination, which does not allow for that type of discovery or cross-examination. Look, as Judge Rader noted in the last appeal,
well,
that we just heard,
it's modeled after the initial examination, but there's an important difference here, right?
Yes.
You have a third party who's contesting a patent, who's challenging the very basis of the patent, and is submitting evidence, and is submitting arguments.
That applies equally to ex parte reexamination, Your Honor, which nobody contends is a contested case. It applies equally. The situation that Cordes' counsel posited up here in his opening statements, Your Honor, was that this is a contested case, he said, because when I tracked it, there was a situation where, as an adversary, he said, Abbott was submitting evidence and argument in support of their arguments, and that could respond to their evidence. That happens in ex parte reexamination. I can initiate an ex parte reexamination. I'm certainly in some vague way contesting the validity of the claims of the patent. If they put in a patent owner statement under the statute, I have the right to submit evidence and argument to respond to that. But that's not how the process was set up. If there were any question, which I think there is not, if there were any question about what congressional intent were, it was answered here. Judge Dyke referred to the new AIA, the Interparties Review process. And as we cite in our brief, and as the record reflects, when Congress enacted the AIA in 2011, they specifically changed the process, and the legislative history reflects this, and they said they were, quote, converting it from an examinational proceeding to an adjudicative proceeding. And part of doing that was sending it to judges rather than examiners. And most importantly, part of doing that specifically, the Congress said this, was that one of the changes that they were making to interparties reexamination was that they were adding discovery, limited discovery, mind you, but that they were adding discovery. That was a change that was deemed an improvement. If it were there all along, if it were there by statute all along, that wouldn't be a change. That would be a non sequitur. But they specifically recognized it as a difference, and when they did that, they felt like they had to send it instead of to examiners to ALJs in that circumstance. And by the way, this notion that there's a difference, some kind of distinction between what they're looking for that is just subpoenas and discovery, that's first of all belied by this absence of any support for that in the case law. The best they have is a passing reference to that Interborough case that makes some vague distinction and doesn't turn on that. And it's certainly belied by what Congress said. In 2011, when Congress added the ability to cross-examine experts in the AIA, what's that under? It's under the caption of discovery. In other words, Congress says that the ability, for example, to cross-examine the declarant is discovery. And again, that's something that they said specifically was a change over what had come before. So we think that based on all the legislative history, based on the PTO's consistent interpretation of this, based on them going to Congress in 2004 and saying, Congress, people aren't using interparties reexamination because there's not discovery allowed, and Congress's reaction, which was not to just say, hey, why don't you just have some discovery, but to change the process radically to being one of adjudication, which is the hallmark of a contested case, rather than examination, that speaks volumes about the fact that, and confirms the plain language of the statute, that no subpoenas were allowed at interparties reexamination in the first place. Turning to the second reason, and I must stress the following.
Any discussion of Section 24 in the legislative history?
Not of 314A, Your Honor. Not to my knowledge.
Of the AIA.
Of the AIA. Well, there is some discussion that in interparties review, in the comments and the rules and regulations, Your Honor, in the comments, they recognize, unlike what they had ever done before in interparties.
I'm talking about the legislative history.
Pardon, Your Honor?
The legislative history of the AIA. Does it discuss Section 24?
Not specifically, Your Honor. It does discuss the unavailability of discovery subpoenas and the such, but it doesn't refer to
Section
24.
So they didn't amend Section 24?
They did not amend Section 24, Your Honor.
Well, are you arguing that because the AIA included discovery, permits discovery, that necessarily means that discovery was not available before?
I would say that in and of itself would be a telling sign, but not dispositive. What's dispositive is that when Congress did so, they specifically called it in the House report an improvement and a difference. And they specifically said it was a transformation from being an examinational proceeding to being an adjudicative proceeding. So the fact that they included is certainly telling, given that it wasn't included in 314A, and given that 314A was modeled after initial examination. But what ends up being dispositive there, beyond the plain language of the statute, is Congress saying, hey, here is a difference between what was available before. That doesn't leave much room for debate. To my knowledge, that hasn't really
Section
even been answered.
Section 24 applies to patent and trademark cases.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And as Judge Dyke pointed out, Section 24 traces its roots back 150 years.
There's no change in the trademark aspect of this.
There's not, Your Honor. I don't think this affects any of the trademark cases. The trademark cases that utilize these procedures, by the way, are cases that are in front of administrative law judges, where one party files the case against the other, that party, for example, can drop the case.
Is there a different rule for trademarks then?
Well, they've promulgated rules at the PTO. This goes to Judge Dyke's point.
No, is a trademark proceeding then a contested case?
Not all trademark proceedings are contested cases, but trademark proceedings that allow discovery, such as opposition type of proceedings, are absolutely contested cases, and they have the hallmarks of contested cases. They look like litigation.
So if the potential for discovery exists, that makes it a contested case?
Not in and of itself, I wouldn't say. I would say that court has formulated the test fairly properly in its initial briefings before the lower court, which was, does it bear the hallmarks of traditional litigation? One pretty good hallmark of traditional litigation is, are you in front of a staff examiner who has no legal training, or are you in front of a judge, for example? In the trademark context, those cases are specifically set up to be in front of judges, have the motions practice, have the cross-examination, have those trappings of litigation. This is a situation where we don't have to divine Congress's intent. Congress has said, hold it like an initial examination, except for as we specifically provide here in this section, and that leaves really no question about what it is. And again, turning to the second reason that the district court's decision should be affirmed, it's Section 24 in and of itself. Again, contested case is a term of art with a long historical pedigree, Your Honors.
That hurts you, doesn't it?
What's that?
That hurts you.
It helps us very much, Your Honor, I think.
How does it help you?
The historical pedigree of contested case shows us, and we agree with Cordes's formulation, that it's not just some blasé use of the terms, that it's a term of art that refers to cases with a hallmark of litigation. Here we have dead opposite.
Where do we find that?
We find that, for example, when you go to the 1861 legislative history with the sponsoring congressman indicating that this was meant to refer to litigants in litigation. We see it referred to in the types of cases that have been treated as contested cases over the year. And we see that this is not a contested case when you look, for example, to the floor statements when the Interparties Reexamination Statute was passed in the first place, where Congress was saying they did not intend to turn this process into one resembling litigation, the opposite of the test that's been espoused that we agree with from Cordes. As Representative Rohrabacher said, all you do in Interparties Reexamination is give a reexam requester the option to further explain why a particular patent should not have been granted. In every real sense, this is returning to initial examination. All that's the difference is that unlike an ex parte reexamination, where in the general sense there may be a contest, here there's some additional opportunities for
those questions. Suppose the PTO had said, instead of saying these are not contested cases, that it said these are contested cases and allowed discovery. Would that be a permissible interpretation of the statute?
I would believe it would not be a permissible interpretation of the statute because we think that it's very well established that a contested case is something that bears the hallmarks of litigation. But B, it wouldn't matter for two reasons. Reason number one would be that, as we point out in our briefs, and is not any contest over this, that in the event that there is a more specific and a more general statute, the more specific statute must control. Here we have a statute specifically addressing the procedures for interparties reexamination. That's 314A. If there were a conflict, it would win out under Section 24. Again, we think there's no such conflict. And the second reason is, as Your Honor pointed out, and we agree with based on Sheehan, based on the legislative history of 23 and 24 being together, if the PTO has not, in Brown, if the PTO has not authorized the discovery, it's a non-starter in the first place, even if it is a contested case. I see I'm well out of my time.
Actually, you consumed your rebuttal time too, Mr. Moore.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Ms. Chaffetz.
Hi, good morning. May it please the Court. Samantha Heifetz on behalf of the United States as amicus in support of the appellee in this case. I think the place to start is perhaps with the arguments that Cordes has advanced this morning. I think they get matters backwards here, and the oral argument this morning has highlighted that in a number of respects. They're really pushing for what is, at bottom, an anomalous result, asking this court to rule that PTO was required to authorize discovery in inter partes reexaminations.
Does it have the authority to authorize discovery?
PTO has broad authority over the conduct of its proceedings. What we know here is that PTO has never understood the scheme created by Congress.
Is that a yes?
I think the answer is that PTO has never understood itself to have that authority here.
Is that a no?
I thought that was a yes. Congress has created the inter partes reexamination scheme, modeled on, as we know, ex parte reexamination and initial examination.
Let's go back.
PTO,
do they have the authority to order discovery or not?
They've certainly never exercised the authority if they have it.
What do you argue? They've never thought that they do.
Look, stepping back.
They do have authority?
They have broad authority under Sections 23 of 35 U.S.C. to make rules about taking testimony and depositions. As Judge Steichen noted earlier.
Could they authorize discovery under Section 24 in inter partes reexamination proceedings?
Possibly. That's certainly never been the case. If they were to have done it, though, this is how it might have happened, right? Section 23 gives them broad authority to make rules about taking of testimony. When you've got two parties in front of PTO, certainly if we had an initial examination rules that somehow facilitated the taking of depositions from third parties not involved in the initial examination, then consistent with the inter partes reexamination statute, I'm referring to 314A, you can certainly imagine a world in which, obviously, here too, we would have rules providing for that kind of discovery. But we don't for very good reason. PTO doesn't make rules about taking depositions or obtaining testimony without looking at what scheme Congress has put in place. And looking at the inter partes reexamination scheme, PTO has always understood that it wasn't meant to include discovery, that Congress was creating a reexamination scheme, an examinational scheme, in the model of initial examinations, looking just like ex parte reexaminations, and that discovery has never been part of that. So the way in which I think Cordes gets matters backwards is that Cordes comes before this court today and suggests that because PTO has never authorized discovery in any kind of examinational proceeding, initial or reexamination, that they therefore ought to be able to obtain it automatically. Well, there's good reason that we have not only not made such rules available, but actually here expressly declined to do so and said that it's not available.
A motion to quash in a district court, I'm trying to figure out why we're spending so much time on the rules of the PTO.
Well, as Judge Dyke noted, Section 24, when it was introduced more than 150 years ago, was part of Section 1 of the Patent Act of 1861. It was part of a single provision that began by giving the Patent Office broad authority to make rules about the taking of depositions, affidavits, etc., and then went on to provide ancillary jurisdiction in the district court to give teeth.
But why do you feel so compelled to be here? What do you have at stake?
Well, we certainly don't want to see discovery be authorized, but we're looking for...
But there's nobody authorizing discovery with this action. We're not... In any sense, no one's moved to authorize discovery at the Patent Office. No one's challenging your rules. This is a motion to quash at a district court. Why am I listening to the PTO?
Well, there's two things at issue here, right? The reason that there should be no subpoenas granted by the district court Number one.
Well, that argument was made by Mr. Morin. Why do I need to hear you on this?
Well, for what that reason is. So Brown and Sheehan got it right. You can't
get a
subpoena.
You don't trust him to make the argument that you feel like you need to somehow defend something that's not at stake?
No, no, I think he got it absolutely right. You can't get that subpoena.
Then why are you
unless
here?
PTO has authorized
it. I'm trying to figure out why you feel threatened here.
Well, if you could go to district court and get a subpoena that PTO hasn't authorized, contrary to Sheehan, contrary to Brown, if you could do what Cordes has suggested today, which is disregard the fact that PTO has not provided for discovery in cases like this, short-circuit that and go to the district court and get the relief you want, that would be problematic for PTO because then, in effect, you would be forcing PTO to provide in its proceedings a space for that discovery
but
to take
place.
But you
were talking to us a moment about your rulemaking authority, and we might have a record on that if this were an APA proceeding challenging your rules. We don't have a record on that, so you're talking kind of beyond our record. You're just
I'm
still struggling to figure out why you think you need to be here.
So on the particular reason of bringing up our rulemaking authority, there I was only looking to respond to Judge Reyna's question.
But you responded by going beyond the record in this case, right? We don't have a record of APA rulemaking challenges or any record of what the APA is at stake at all.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The reason I was going beyond what's at issue in this case is because the question went beyond. The question was whether PTO could have had authority or does have authority to do that which it did not do. This case is not about whether or not
I guess you
PTO
get the point. I'm saying that the reason you're having to go beyond the record is because you shouldn't be here.
Well, I think there's two reasons that we have something worth saying before this court today. So one is a concern about properly decided. I think you know this case could be decided without our presence. Our concern is that the result that Cordes is looking for would certainly implicate our interests. And so the case is not about whether or not there was any statutory bar to PTO exercising its broad rulemaking authority if it had chosen to do so and if it had thought it appropriate to do so. But the reality is, contrary to that hypothetical question that we began with, the PTO has never thought that it would have been appropriate, consistent, that is, with the scheme that Congress sought to create in 1999.
It's immaterial whether the PTO has decided or has not exercised any type of authority to establish rules if, in fact, it has no authority.
Well,
isn't that why you're here? I thought you were here because you're here to argue there is no authority.
We're here certainly to say, look, regardless of what could have been done under broader authority that PTO has over the conduct of the proceedings,
to me is correct.
That.
If everything you're saying to me is correct, why do we have jurisdiction? Why don't we just wait for the APA case, which has been placed on hold while we're waiting for this motion to quash to come out of the way? You're addressing the other case, aren't you? And if the other case were before us, I would expect you to argue first and Mr. Morin to sit over there and talk, but I'm not even sure why you're here when the APA case isn't before us.
We're here as amicus. We're not a party to this
yes,
case.
Yes, you're arguing the other case, but the other case isn't before us.
And the other case is implicated here insofar as
it's
the decision...
It's not before us.
It's absolutely not before you, Your Honor, but it's implicated because
does
the holding
case have
of this
any
court...
Significance? Does this case have any significance for any other case? I mean...
Absolutely.
Why does it have significance? Because my understanding is that inter partes reexamination as it used to exist is eliminated. So... the new PTO rules and the new statute present a different question. Why do, you know, apart from resolving this particular case, what significance does this have?
Well, we have over 1,000 cases that are still pending under the old inter partes reexamination proceedings. And when Congress passed the AIA, they only made the inter partes review, which is very significant here for all of the reasons that my colleague, counsel for Abbott, talked about. Only made it applicable prospectively. Now, at the time that they did it, it's also interesting to note, In passing the AIA, they not only created inter partes review prospectively, which of course creates the what they called in the House report the improvement of providing for discovery that they described as moving from the old examinational system to the new adjudicative system, all things my colleague discussed. They also actually made some amendments to the old inter partes reexamination statute. They changed the standard for the initial determination by PTO as to whether to undertake reexamination. So they were certainly involved in the old inter partes reexamination provisions. So their understanding of what those provisions provide for, what's involved in inter partes reexamination, is obviously extremely relevant. They clearly knew that PTO did not authorize discovery and did not think discovery was appropriate, right? They could have made changes had they thought so. They did not. But under that old scheme, the old scheme remains in effect for the cases, for petitions filed up until September 16th, 2012. And so we've got about 1,000, over 1,000 cases pending. And this case, no one else has sought discovery, but obviously if this panel were to say that parties to reexamination proceedings can go into district courts despite the fact that PTO has said in the PTO decision at issue in the Eastern District of Virginia that they ought not to be able to obtain relief under Section 24. Nonetheless, that they can, that obviously has implications for PTO, its allocation of resources, all of these more than 1,000 cases.
It will delay the resolution of these cases.
Absolutely. It also would raise questions about ex parte reexamination, which is not eliminated under the America Invents Act, right? I mean, well, one of the fundamental problems.
How could it do that?
Well, one of the fundamental.
How could an ex parte reexamination be a contested case?
Look, one of the fundamental difficulties with Cordes's case is that their definition, if accepted, does seem to encompass ex parte reexaminations, as absurd as that sounds.
It does sound absurd.
Right, but that is the definition they've offered. They've come before the court. Their brief says, look, it's whenever you have a party contesting the position that another party has taken. That's what you find in ex parte reexaminations just as much as in inter partes reexamination. And that, all of this speaks to why we're here as amicus, not as a party to this case, but with concerns about what the implications of this court's ruling would be. It would, Cordes is asking for the truly anomalous holding that PTO...
Your red light's been on for some time, Ms. Heifetz.
Let me just offer up the rest of that final sentence, if that is okay, that PTO was required by Congress to provide for, to allow discovery, and that discovery can be obtained in district courts, notwithstanding the fact that PTO has always exercised its authority and its discretion and its interpretation of the statutory scheme to understand the opposite result should obtain. Thank the court for its time.
Lucci?
Yes, Your Honor. One thing I think needs to be cleared in the record, and I can certainly understand why both of my opponents referred to the term discovery as much as they did and tried to paint all the parade of horribles that would be supposedly would come into being if discovery were in place. We are not seeking discovery. As I mentioned, there's a long line of cases drawing a distinction in administrative context between subpoena sought for purposes of discovery and those seeking the introduction of evidence into the record. We are not seeking discovery.
What is a subpoena? Isn't that discovery?
Not in this context, Your Honor. No, it isn't. There's the cases NLRB versus Interborough, Sheehan versus Doyle, and a number of other cases in the record draw a distinction between subpoenas, which are for purposes of discovery, as opposed to subpoenas for the entry of evidence into the record. That's a well-established distinction. In this case, you know, looking back, as Your Honor, Judge Dyke mentioned, legislative history is important. Looking back at 1861 and the procedures that were in place in terms of litigation and in the PTO at that time, it's instructive. The things which Abbott points to as being sort of the trappings or hallmarks of litigation, motion practice, depositions, and many of the discovery techniques, they came into being in the 1930s. They did not exist at the time in 1861.
Who presided over an interference proceeding in 1861.
An examiner did, Your Honor. An examiner in the PTO presided over an interference proceeding, and that was recognized in part in this court's decision in Ray Guyon's in 1991. An examiner proceeded. So in 1861, the conduct of litigation looked a lot like what we're talking about now in terms of the PTO proceedings. An adversary who has the opportunity throughout the course of the proceeding or the case to introduce argument and evidence. And that's significant to put the historical context. Now, counsel for the PTO mentioned that there's similarities between ex parte reexamination and inter partes reexamination. That's simply not the case in terms of this feature of having a participant throughout the proceeding presenting the opposing view. Counsel for Abbott mentioned the possibility of the third party requester in an ex parte reexamination having a second opportunity to put in some comments. As counsel undoubtedly knows, however, that's only if the patent owner puts in a statement. It's also the case that in the exceedingly small number of percentage of cases, does a patent owner do that? In the vast majority of cases, the patent owner, for strategic reasons, doesn't put in that statement and freezes out the third-party requester, such that an ex parte reexamination is not contested through the participation of an adversary in the way that an inter partes reexamination is. Now, there was also a comment made about how inter partes reexamination is modeled after ex parte reexamination, and it's important to look at the statutory difference. It's perhaps a semantic one, but Congress was careful about its semantics. If you take a look at the statute for ex parte reexamination, the participants in an ex parte reexamination are not referred to as parties. In Section 303B, for example, there's a reference to the person requesting reexamination. That stands in contrast with Section 314B1, which refers to documents being filed by either party, either the patent owner or the third party, being served on the other party. The semantic difference is important. They're parties to an adversarial proceeding in which each of them has the opportunity throughout, and not just in an exceedingly small number of instances as in an ex parte reexamination, but throughout, to present a contrary view of the case along with additional evidence. And unless there's further questions from the court.
Thank you, Mr. Lucci. I think that concludes this proceeding.